Hey guys, welcome to episode 160 of the JV Club. Ugh, I don't know what that was. I want to welcome you guys in. I'll tell you what, here's one of my favorite funny people,
John Ross Bowie.
If you are familiar with his beautiful, wonderful, extremely talented wife, Jamie Denbo, you will probably be ready, willing, and able to enjoy this episode. If you know John and you don't know Jamie, I strongly encourage you to go back and listen to Jamie's episode. Overall, I just want to invite you to enjoy yourself. I want to get some shout outs out there, guys. I am catching up. I want to focus mostly on emails I've gotten from people in the last couple of weeks. I want to thank, I think I individually responded to each one of you, but my website being down necessitated a total reboot, and I didn't get a lot of the messages that came through to janet@janetvarney.com until very recently. So the delay was due to that, guys. But I do want to thank, of course, my sweet Rebecca for reminding me that I'm a meaningful person. And in general, guys, a lot of you have reminded me via Twitter, Facebook, and email that I am meaningful following Mark Evan Jackson's wonderful episode. So thank you for that. I'm feeling very meaningful and very deep, heavy, contented, sigh-y indeed. I want to thank Damon for your awesome Mary Birdsong email. I want to thank Chiaki. Great to hear from you. Mary Jo, Oliver, and Christine sent me some great guest recommendations. Thank you for that. Steven McPhee, always like to get your feedback. Evan, Mary Rose, Drew, Sean, Markey, and Janae and her beautiful wife. Thank you guys so much. News-wise, I would just maybe throw out to you that I'm going to be at the Connecticon Comic-Con the second week, weekend of July, and then following that, I'll be at the Vancouver Comic Con, and I'll also be doing the JV Club at LA Podfest. So, guys, that feels like a lot of news. I'm going to leave you with that and welcome you in. I will talk to you soon. Good day to you.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Now that we've just unloaded psychologically to the point where we'll come up totally dry, it will just be like a really empty.
Seen any good movies?
Super positive.
Yeah, we're just going to talk about Pitch Perfect 2. Seen any good movies?
Pitch Perfect. I haven't seen Pitch Perfect 1. I can't speak to either.
Pitch Perfect 1's good.
Are they good?
Pitch Perfect 1's good.
Okay, great, great, great. But you've seen both.
Yes.
Good to know. Perfect. Yeah. We live in a world where I guess you have to be like conscious of people. All of our friends are in all of the movies that we do or do not see.
Right.
got it. Got it. Understood. God, have you seen any? I never talk about movies on the. Well, that's not true. I guess I talk about movies, but not in a sort of.
What am I saying? I mean, I went out of my way, got a sitter so I could go see Fury Road.
I don't even know what Fury Road is.
The Mad Max movie.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I haven't seen it yet. I've never seen any of the Mad Maxes.
Oh, they're entertaining. They're very entertaining.
The Mad Max Eye. I don't know what the plural is. The
Mad Max Eye. Uh-huh. Max Eye. Mm-hmm. No, what I've seen is I've seen all the children's films that are out.
Of course.
Repeatedly.
Are you so excited when something like a Pixar movie comes out and you know that there's going to be something for you?
That's
got to become like mecca of.
Yeah, well, you sit through like a million Rio 2s before you get to like an Inside Out, which I'm told is very good and I'm dying to see it.
Yeah, I'm sure it's great.
Yeah, because you're going to spend a lot of Saturday afternoons with your kids at these movies.
Did we have that? Like, were there that many bad? Did I see a bunch of bad movies with my parents? Because I don't remember that.
No, I feel
like we saw the Muppet movies.
And that's all there was, really. Maybe you sat through a Benji movie, which weren't very good. Over than you, and I think that might be.
No,
better.
I remember Benji, but I don't even really remember caring about Benji.
Well, they also were very, very busy buying cigarettes and cases of Tab.
That's right.
And as such, I'm not saying that I wasn't a priority, but like they were just like, we're going to sit down, we're going to watch the local news.
Right.
In the 70s in New York, John.
Oh,
so
God.
Let me explain Nothing how the Son of Sam works.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
to just be sort of dunked into, did you feel in that way that you were like the opposite of sort of what we have now, which is like these, you know, the helicopter parents? I don't know, but that's a term that I think we're all tired of. But did you feel like there was a sense of, because a lot of the time when on this podcast, because we talk about our childhoods or our teen years, there is a recurrent theme of, you know, I would leave my house on my bike in the morning and I wasn't expected to come back until dinner and no one cared and no one thought anything bad was going to happen. And that somehow that time has since passed and no one lets that happen anymore. Like, I feel like that's a thing that comes back repeatedly.
Yeah. I mean, again, growing up in central Manhattan, there was no like, here, get on your bike and just go riding. Because you're just not going to do that in, you know, it's not like it was never the suburbs, so there was never. But I had a little bit more leeway than I would give my kids in those circumstances. I was allowed to stay on my block between 9th and 10th Avenue on 44th Street.
But God, you really were right in it.
I was, yeah. In the city. But I couldn't go off the block. I couldn't go on. And one time I went around the corner to the deli on 9th and 45th, and I felt so bad that I confessed to my mom and she lost her fucking mind. And, you know, in all fairness, like, she had one rule, just don't go off the block.
Yeah.
Don't go off the block. Because we had actually kind of a quiet, 44th Street was always kind of a quiet enclave in Hell's Kitchen. And it was already getting a little yuppie in the 70s. And there were like, just a lot of like really nice gay guys decorating their apartments up and down the block. And the Actors Studio was on the block.
Okay. All right.
So it was never like this hub of gang activity.
Right.
But, so the deal was you stay on this block and you play with Shepherd or the Denabley kids down the street and that would be it.
Someone was named Shepherd?
His name was Shepherd. Shepherd's last name. In hindsight, he was kind of a dick.
Stupid Shepherd.
Fucking Shepherd. But yeah, you couldn't, you certainly couldn't go on to 10th Avenue, and 9th Avenue was just busy and crazy, and you didn't want to head over there either. So you had these very simple boundaries. The other thing that one very, very clear rule that I had until I left the house at 18 was I was not allowed under any circumstances on 42nd Street between 7th and 8th, which was like the big – that's when you see pictures of 42nd Street, that's like Taxi Driver 42nd Street.
Okay.
Like that stretch with all the porn theaters and the grindhouses stuff. I was not allowed on that stretch.
And God, it's so close. That is in such close proximity.
Yeah. And so, like, I never – and we would do – it was so weird because a lot of my friends had that rule. Like, you just don't go on the deuce. Leave that alone.
Sure.
But we would do other things. Like, we're like, well, let's go, you know, let's go up and see a horror movie up in Harlem instead. And that'll be really exciting. And we would do that instead. And that That was our vicarious thrill. Yes, exactly. Yeah. That was our bug chasing at the time.
But God, that is still so much more over the top thrill chasing than, you know, somebody who's growing up in the suburbs and their version of that is, I don't know what. I mean, I guess maybe it's like meth. I don't know.
Maybe it's meth. The thing was, is like, then how come there were these kids in my high school who were also doing angel dust? I was like, what? This isn't exciting enough for you? We take our life into our hands every time we get on the subway.
Yeah. I forgot about angel dust.
Yeah, yeah.
What's angel dust? Is it related to heroin in some way?
No, it's a hallucinogenic.
First of all, it is the most pleasant sounding next to ecstasy.
Oh, yeah.
Were just like, listen, we're just going to call it a state of mind that is the best state of mind you could possibly be in. Very smart marketing to call it ecstasy.
Ecstasy's branding is across the board perfect. Angel dust, from all accounts, is not okay. It should be called apparently hell fever or something. Okay.
It's sort of a crack equivalent in terms of like, don't, or PCP, like don't mess with
it.
It
is PCP.
Oh, it is PCP.
Angel dust is PCP.
What does PCP stand for?
I used to know, actually. Yeah. Phenos. Something or other.
Sounds right.
But it's a hallucinogen that is usually either cut with speed or is filled with was supposed to be filled with speed.
So
you don't know what the fuck's going on and you've got all the energy in the world to deal with it.
Yeah, that is a terrible combination.
It's a terrible combination.
Because at least with like all the LSD that I did, it wasn't a motivating drug. It wasn't like, I didn't, I mean, you could just sit around and do nothing, but like the most you would do would just be to wander aimlessly and touch things that other people would be like, there's no need to touch that. I don't know why you're fascinated by that.
Jamie and I took shrooms and went to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam.
Oh, great. What a great use of all of it. Yeah,
exactly. You know, and nobody is ever going to look back at that and go, God, I wish I hadn't done that. Right. But you never hear anybody like get nostalgic about angel dust. You really don't like.
I remember when I stabbed that guy in the face with a toothpick at Denny's. Boy, I really thought he was
seeing. I thought I could fly, and there was a plate glass window, and good times. It was a simpler time.
Oh, wow.
Ed Koch's New York.
That's right. God, I guess I forgot that you were straight up Manhattanite.
I forgot you were raised Mormon, so we got that in common.
These things to get back together on.
We had Mormons in New York. I dated a Mormon.
You dated a Mormon in New York City?
Yeah.
That does seem rare.
I'm still friends with her. They belong to the temple that's right across from Lincoln Center.
Now, that's a very Jewish thing to say. Because we don't have temples unless you're getting married in them.
Oh, well, pardon fucking me. They're building right across from...
what is the name? I mean, I guess it's just a church.
It's just a church, you're right.
But like, if she went to... But inside the church, you go, like, you sort of divide up. I'm not going to get too into that way it all works, but I'm sure I've said this word before because I'm always fascinated by it, but you belong to a ward.
That's it.
Right.
Yes.
So her ward was, she probably shared the building with another ward. And so she would go at a certain time, like based on the neighborhood.
Oh, I bet that's
where
the
she
case.
Was.
Yeah. I don't remember. I'm sure there's more than one Mormon church in New York. The only one I can think of is that one across from Lincoln
Center. I wouldn't be surprised if there weren't many. In San Francisco, I was like, I only know of one. That's like one in San Francisco, one in the East Bay. I don't think that they're like, it's not like Tucson where there's a large population that, you know, requires multiple buildings.
Well, I mean, just the New York stereotype of everybody comes there is accurate.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they had a not a thriving community, but there were a few of them.
Hanging on for dear life amidst the crazy 70s and 80s of glitzy and crappy New York.
There was a part of me, I mean, that relationship didn't last very, very long. And then, you know, we took a little time.
Is this
off
in high school?
This was high school.
Were your parents like, you need to date a Jewish girl?
I'm not Jewish. That is
oh my God!
Popular misconception.
I totally thought
it
you were
a super popular misconception.
Why did I think that even Jamie?
Oh come on!
I mean, I guess I just didn't.
You know why you thought?
Because you
look at me.
You don't look Jewish to me.
People tell me I do.
Really?
And I play Jews so often.
Well,
on
maybe
television.
That's just all it is. But like, also, I know Jamie to be Jewish, so
well,
we sort of
she
think about that.
It's a second or third thing, and she's fascinated by the fact that. She's this blonde with a tiny little nose, and I'm her Gentile husband. She loves that. She's obsessed with
she's
the fact that
swimming
like,
around.
I'm the Jew. He isn't. Isn't that crazy? No, I was raised Episcopalian, and but I was raised in New York, and you know, another stereotype that's true is we're all vaguely Jewish. Like I know Puerto Rican guys who speak a smattering of Yiddish because you just do.
Yeah,
you just it's immersion therapy.
I mean, I guess it is that's a real case of you. That is a real case of you have so many. Just random characteristics that you have no control over, be them environmental or marriage or, you know, all of that kind of stuff that like, it really does drop you right into the middle of like, well, I assume he's Jewish.
Yeah.
I feel shame that I also went along with that, but
all seriously, because it's such
misconception. I really even thought that like I knew that you were. It's so funny.
Most people do.
It's so funny,
and it's so weird too because everyone.
What
knows.
Are your parents? Are your parents like? I don't know why everyone thinks my son's Jewish.
My father, who spoke a ton of Yiddish, my father was like multilingual, which was super annoying because I have no gift for foreign languages at all. He adored Jamie and was thoroughly thrilled when we got married under a chuppah, and he was totally into that. And my mom just shrugs it off, you know? My mom's just like, oh, this is what people think my son's Jewish. He plays Jewish all the time. The craziest thing that ever happened was I auditioned for an Oxygen movie of the week back when they were doing Oxygen movies of the week for a character named Dr. Chan. And I was like, talked to my agent. I was like, I have to go in for this, do I? And they were like, they want to see everybody. They want to see
they
everybody.
They really mean it this time.
And I'm like, okay, they say that. They have to say that by law. The guy's name is Dr. Chan.
Right.
I go in. This is like 10 or 12 years ago. And like... Masioka, Randall Park, all these guys who I know, and they're all like, the fuck are you doing here? Hit the road, Bowie. Beat traffic. And that's what I said. They want to see everybody. So yeah. I book it, of course, because there's no point in telling the story unless I book it at the end. And I am praying to God that they're going to keep the name Dr. Chan and just never comment on
it. Yes.
They changed it to Lipschitz.
Of course they did.
They changed it to Lipschitz.
Of course they did.
Dr. Lipschitz.
The most hilarious Jewish name.
The most hilarious
they
Jewish
could
name.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Pull.
Unless you're going to make something up like Jewberg. It's just, you know, you have to go with Lipschitz. And,
preposterous.
Preposterous. It was Janine Garofalo, Swoozie Kurtz.
I love everything I'm hearing. Listen, I love both of those ladies. What a great movie of the week. What was it about?
It was Nadine in Dateland, and Janine Garofalo, who I don't think was very happy to be there, was
she may not have been.
Ran a dating service, but couldn't find love herself.
Boy, that's every other pilot that you read during pilot season.
That
also
is correct. The only thing I can say for it, this was 2005.
It was way ahead.
A little
ahead
of its time.
Way ahead. Leaps and bounds.
We have that. But Dr. Chan became Dr. Lipschitz because everyone just thinks it's easier to make me Jewish.
Sure.
And I...
Did you have that? Was that something that... I mean, because when you sort of land in LA, it's very easy to get pigeonholed anyway. And some of that... You sort of people can like fight tooth and nail against, and some of it becomes like, you know what? I'm fine with that. You know what I mean? Go ahead.
Well, no, the only thing worse than being typecast is not being cast, and I do firmly believe
there you go.
That. But
there
yeah,
you go.
Right, like within a month and a half, I booked a pilot with a character name of Wally Berman.
Yeah,
and Wally Berman had all sorts of jokes. I definitely had a joke about how I couldn't fit into my bar mitzvah suit anymore.
Perfect.
But yeah, he was just – Wally Berman was just who I was, right? Like within a month and a half of arriving in Los Angeles.
Did you – but and so my question is, did you anticipate that? Like was that something – is that something that Hollywood has created in your marriage?
Do I show up with a prayer shawl or what are you asking?
No, but like in high school, like is that a product of the typecasting of Hollywood or is it – Or was that something that, like, did anyone think you were Jewish when you were in high school, like, that you just met, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I was friends with Ben Posnack and Matt Israel, and I just kind of blended in, and this was my crew.
Yeah.
And Jim Nacklin, who was technically not, because his mom was Dr. McCoy, so we called her Bones, so that was awesome.
Of course you did, perfect.
He was a dentist named Dr. McCoy.
That's beautiful.
I was just... the girl I dated for like most of my 20s, like 18 to 27 actually, she was Jewish. And does it sound weird to say I'm just really comfortable around Jews?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know dancing around the sort of like cultural do's and don'ts or what's PC and what's not. I don't really know how to answer that, but particularly as, you know, someone who looks like I do.
You should be ushering my wife into a cattle car.
God, this is really a great companion podcast to Jamie's. I definitely dated Jewish boys in high school. Those were the guys I was attracted to. They were artistic and funny.
While you were practicing Mormon?
I was never, I mean, was I practicing? Did I ever believe it? No. I did. I was forced to go to church on Sundays because that's when my mom had custody of me.
Okay.
But I didn't identify as Mormon, and that certainly wouldn't have been the objection that, you know, my boyfriend's moms had. The only objection would just be that I wasn't Jewish. Not that I was anything but, you know, anything but not Jewish was not great. But like, I feel like there was a point in time in which I was like, I mean, I would convert.
Really?
Like, I just thought it was I loved the culture of it. I loved bar and bat mitzvahs. I felt like I could relate to that relationship to God somehow better than I would somewhere else until I had none at all or no interest at all. But, you know, it was sort of like understandably appealing. I loved all my friends' Jewish parents. Like, it felt like very, and even now when we do shows at the JCC, in San Francisco through Sketchfest, I go there and I have like a real sense of like longing for the director makes fun of me because I'm like, I want to come here with my,
Well, it's hard when you're, here's a long overdue answer to the question is when you're 13 and suddenly your friends are men and women.
Sure.
That is striking.
Yeah.
And you are, And like, I had a confirmation in the Episcopal Church, which is not the same thing.
What is the confirmation?
The confirmation is, I'm not even sure what it's honestly supposed to mean. It's just that you're old enough, and I did it when I was around 14, 13, around in that pocket. You're old enough to identify as a Christian, as an Episcopalian.
Okay, yeah.
And it's sort of like a, kind of like a second baptism.
Mm-hmm. You're an adult now, and you're actively choosing, which probably you
but
still
there's
are.
No party, and there's no DJ, and they don't throw down the way Jonathan Cram did when he rented when the Crams rented the last automat on 42nd Ooh. Street and 3rd, and we had a massive party there.
Yeah.
That was, you know, with streamers and, you know, Mylar balloons, because, again, 1982, 83.
Sure.
So that was, I mean, that was something.
Yes,
This
Pee-wee confirmation bullshit.
Yeah, it was not interesting. So it's hard not to kind of look through the window and be like, what's going on there? You guys having a party? And then there's something about the sort of Reform Judaism that that is in my life right now, that's very questioning, you know, and very seeking answers, and, you know, okay, this is what the Torah says. What does that mean in 2015? And that's kind of interesting to me. And you don't find that.
Well,
level.
It doesn't feel as fear based.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
It's like,
also,
we're not. Hey, you know what? We're not afraid to find out that maybe this isn't exactly what we thought it was, or this is maybe there's a new way we need to look at this because, you know, of this, this, and this. Like, that's very
debate
exciting.
And inquiry are kind of built into the
absolutely.
Faith, and that's really interesting. And I think if you were raised Mormon adjacent, that's got to be incredible.
Which is a good example of a religion that's like, by all means, ask questions. And so you sort of do. There's a lot of like bait and for me anyway, personally.
Right,
and
sure.
I know I have Mormon listeners, and I welcome you to argue with me. But for me, there's a little bit of a bait and switch that happens, which is like, oh no, we identify more with like Judaism, or we identify with Reformed, or we identify with these sort of more contemporary versions of things in X,
religion,
Y, and Z ways. Because we're 25 minutes old, exactly. And we're, you know, listen, that's how our church got started, is Joseph Smith was like, I don't know if any of these religions are right for me. And that's how he got this message from God. And, you know, Mormons have a personal relationship with God in a way that is very American. I say this all the time when I talk about Mormonism, but it feels very American to be like, listen, I could get a revelation tomorrow. And granted, there's a person who's in constant contact with God who has the big granddaddy revelations that affect the church.
Right.
But like, you know, that's why there are these Mormon sects that break off, where people are like, actually, I'm the prophet.
Right.
Because everyone kind of, it's like, it is sort of like the streets are lined with gold. It's like, in Mormonism, everyone's in charge, kind of. I mean, except for women, they don't have the priesthood, but there's a sense of
and
kind
black
of.
People was in 1978.
I mean, it's speaking of not ahead of the curve, behind every curve. But yeah, the sense of sort of like, you should totally ask questions.
Right.
And then you're like, well, why this? And then they're like, the answer will be revealed in time.
Oh, wow. That's
you know what I mean? Okay, so it was okay for me to ask, but like, I shouldn't expect an answer. Got it. You know what I mean? So
ask away.
It's its own little thing.
We reserve the right to not comment.
Yeah, yeah.
That's hard.
Well, not to make this poor girl in high school, not to make you tell her life, but did you guys, I mean...
No.
Okay. So she was addressing it enough that
she was
not going to have sex.
Enough. And I think I was... we were drawn to each other because I was straight edge in high school, and obviously she was too. Ta-da. So we had that in common.
So that's a different than that. Obviously, that's very different than just being sort of like square. Like being straight edge is,
I mean, it is ultimately just being square, but it has an in the
but
in
were
New
you
York in the
music
80s.
And dressing in a certain way. What did that entail?
I mean, I was listening to like a lot of the hardcore that was going on at the time in New York, like Youth of Today and Side by Side and stuff like that. That was all straight edge hardcore. So I had. That sort of it was just a way of being square, but sort of draping it in cool clothes.
I kind of love that. Yeah. I don't think that I spent enough time, nor have I ever talked about it enough, for how much I'm realizing in this exact moment that I really love that. I kind of love. Because I did all the drugs and stuff, and like I wouldn't change anything in the sense that like I'm comfortable with who I am now, but I think part of that was attached, obviously, to like all of the stuff I was into.
Yeah.
And friends of mine who were straight edge, even then, I definitely didn't turn my nose up. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I had friends who were very squeaky clean, mm-hmm. who were great students, who were kind of religious, that I did sort of go like I looked down. I didn't look down on, but I feel I condescended to in the way teenagers condescend towards another. Yeah, where it's just like, oh, yeah, you don't really know like what's going on. Like artistically, you're probably not allowing yourself to grow. And I didn't feel that about my straight edge friends. My straight edge friends, I was like, you have an identity that's like, you're very confident and you're like into a lot of the music I'm into, but you're just like, fuck drugs.
Right.
And I absolutely respected that, right. You know? It's a great way to deliver that message in a way that's still like, it feels, speaking of like great marketing and ecstasy, it feels like, oh, thank God someone figured that out. I don't know who that person was, but great.
And it also, by the time I was in high school, it gave me this incredible bargaining tool with mm-hmm. my parents in mm-hmm. the sense like, you know that I'm coming home just smelling of sweat.
Yeah.
That's it. I'm out at CB's till 2 o'clock in the morning, but it's okay because I have my wits about me.
I think that's great.
And everything else is fine. And that gave me an inordinate amount of leeway.
Yeah.
To wander around 80s New York just because I wasn't getting fucked up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that bought me a lot of time. But I did the whole thing where like I put the X on my hand with the Sharpie. And I kind of committed to it.
Yeah. And like honestly, I mean, especially in high school when you're as malleable as you are and like, you know, I certainly would get really excited about whatever my friend that I had a crush on, you know, as a friend crush would be, or that I was, you know, had a crush on, or the girl that I had a crush on, or whatever it was. I feel like I was one person away from becoming straight edge. Like I probably could have, you know what I mean? If I'd fallen for someone in mm-hmm. whatever way that I got intimate with on some level, I easily could have been like, immediately transformed into like, I'm done with all that stuff, guys. Now I'm straight edge.
Right.
but how did that come to be for you? How did you end up with that X on your hand?
I wasn't, I was simply just not drinking and not smoking pot and, wanted to own that in a way. And, oddly enough, a pothead punk rocker in my bio class in ninth grade turned me on to Minor Threat and said, oh, these guys are like that. They have a song called Straight Edge. And it was part of the Straight Edge movement. There was a sect of the Straight Edge movement that wouldn't even have sex. And I was like, well, that's crazy. That's, uh-huh. So that's something I need to put a lot of my energy towards that.
That's, by dating a Mormon girl.
That's correct. Well, you know, the Mormon thing came between a couple of other young ladies. But and I should mention at this point that the Mormon girl had impeccable taste in music, and she just moved from Seattle, so she me into the Unfresh Fellows before anybody knew who they were. She got me into I want to say Soundgarden, all these great bands before before I the Posies, before anybody else was talking about them. So she was a Mormon with impeccable musical taste. She still does, but the straight edge thing was just. I found it because I was doing it anyway, and I just wanted to give mm-hmm. it a name.
Yeah.
You know, and that was, and it was, but I was still.
Did you have lots of friends in different groups anyway? Like, obviously, you know.
Yeah, I was friends with the Deadheads, some of whom eventually started to dabble in heroin. And
oh, my God.
Some of the other punk rocker kids were not straight edge at all.
Right.
And, I had all sorts of, it was sort of a United Nations of weirdos at my high school. So.
That is really, God, I am still holding on to this fascination with the idea of, because I'm trying to think I've ever had anybody who straight up was from New York. I mean, you know, so many of our friends that are from New Jersey or from, you know, they'll be from Long Island, they'll be from someplace where they come into the city a lot, but there's still this separation and a real sense of division between, I guess, well, you know who, the only person I can think of is Zandi Hardig, David Wayne's wife. She was definitely a Manhattanite, but I think her world was very sort of.
She went to private school.
Buttoned down.
I want to say she went to, did she go to Friends? She's pretty, I think she might have.
She went to Friends Seminary. Great. I think she may have. I can't quite remember, but very few people I know who really, I guess the sort of, as long as we're speaking in cliches and I'm assuming you're Jewish, I'll also say that there does seem like, based on what you described in 42nd Street, all that, you know, there was definitely like there's a very seedy element and a very dangerous element to Tucson, Arizona, because it's near the border. And it's, sure. I think it's like always near the top of like high crime cities.
Yeah.
And certainly the magnet schools that I went to were like not in good neighborhoods and you weren't supposed to leave campus and right. all that kind of stuff. But I still feel like the difference between that and just like really being in Manhattan, like you're seeing in the same way that you do in any kind of metropolitan city where you're taking public transport, you know, and all that kind of stuff, you're just kind of dropped into it in such a different way. Do you feel like the kids around you and yourself had a maturity level that just comes with being exposed to like everything good and bad and in a more direct way?
I guess you wouldn't know. Yeah, that's the other thing is that people are always like, what was it like growing up in New York? And it's like, I don't know. I don't know what it was like growing up in Swampscott, Massachusetts.
That's what it was, what it was.
Which is where my wife is from. What I can tell you is that, yeah, I got mugged when I was 8 on one hand. And on the other hand, I took a date to the opera in my senior year of high school.
Yeah.
Because you can do both of those things.
Yeah,
both of those things, getting mugged when you're 8 and taking a date to see Rigoletto at the Met are both possible.
To me, that does seem, it's funny because the only opera I've ever seen in New York was Rigoletto. Recently.
It's a hit.
I guess you're right. It's not like the rarest thing in the world. But yeah, I mean, I think that does answer the question because that does
speak to
both things. I mean, that's just like getting used to the idea of something that some people spend their whole lives not being used to, which is like you can be mugged or, you know, you can go to the, I don't know.
That's the way I'd phrase it though. I would be very hesitant to use the word maturity.
Sure, sure, sure.
I would use...
No, that's... You're right.
There's experience a tendency to just get used to crazy shit.
Yeah.
And I remember when I would go to a camp in Connecticut, and we would... The camp itself was in Ivoryton, but we'd go on these little five-day hiking trips, like along like little chunks of the Appalachian Trail or whatever, all these great little northeastern mountain ranges. And it would be some kids from New York, some kids from like Westchester County, some kids from suburban Connecticut. And once we got onto the trail, it was the suburban kids who were complaining the most because the New York kids were like, well, we're uncomfortable. What's new?
You know? Right, right, right.
Well, yeah, my feet hurt. Big deal. Yeah, this is a thing. This is life. I don't, you know. So it wouldn't, again, I wouldn't say maturity, but there's like an early level of jadedness comes over, you know.
Absolutely.
It's just like, this is uncomfortable. This is the life to which we are born.
Right. Well, do you feel like there's a sense of distrust, too, that comes from seeing more? Or is it like...
There's a cynicism, I think.
I mean, I guess I'm tap dancing around neurosis, too, because there is a sort of cliche of New York neuroses, Jewish or not, but...
Oh, yeah, that's another thing, I think, why people think I'm Jewish, is that I am a nervous wreck. And
but you know what? Don't you perpetuate that on purpose. I think you do the same thing I do, which is whatever quality I'm most embarrassed of, I will be the first to say something about, to own it, and to be like, let's just...
I would rather talk about it than have people talk about it behind my back.
Right.
Or like, I'd like
but
to
But what's
be...
funny is that I never get a sense from you that the only thing I can ever... And I grant you, we haven't spent a ton of time together, but we have known each other a long time. I don't have any sense of you as actually being the thing that you're joking about. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I have friends who joke about how neurotic they are, and I see it all the time.
Because I'm so guarded.
Oh, good job, though.
Thank you. Thank you.
Because now you've created this character for yourself that is totally hiding a real thing, but it is effectively hiding it. Because I'm like, I don't know why he says he's so neurotic. I never see that. You know what I mean? All I see is him joking about it.
Well, I've definitely gotten better, and it's through, you know, talk therapy, and living in Southern California has definitely taken an edge off.
Yeah.
It is easier to live. I mean, my kids were out front of our house the other day, just like playing around, and I couldn't imagine letting them do that in contemporary New York, and it just felt, and it, Southern California has just calmed me down a lot. You know, that's another cliche that I'm leaning into.
Yeah.
But it's, I'm here 13 Why years not? Now, and it's a lot easier to kind of keep a cool head and relax. And if it gets really hairy, you can drive an hour and a half and be in the desert.
Right,
and
right.
talk to God.
That's right. Absolutely. Those Joshua trees. The Joshua trees.
Get out there and paint yourself.
I mean, you really can if you need to. and so how did that, did it, take its shit, and I mean, I guess this is pretty personal, but like
you are asking fascinating questions.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm fascinated by you in a good way. seen any good movies lately? No. But like, in terms of neuroses and that kind of stuff, Is that, what am I trying to say? This really does feel like a therapy question, but I can answer it also. Like, I know okay. why I'm asking okay. this question. Is it like, okay, here's the thing. For me as a teenager, especially, and the ways in which I've become less neurotic over time, were more internalized. It was more for me about, and I think everyone can relate to this and we all hold on to it sometimes more than we think that we're going to, which is like you're in high school and you sort of hope that as an adult you're not going to have these qualities, and you do, but you just live with them differently or you right. get over it or whatever. But mine were more internal about, you know, what does this person think? Did I upset this person? Am I blank enough? Am I not blank enough? Or am I like that sort of worrying? But it wasn't like, I'm afraid that I'm going to get mugged, or I'm going to afraid that I'll get an illness, or I'm afraid. Do you know what I'm saying? And so I'm wondering both. If yours were both, or yeah. Because, you know, some people don't, their internal monologue is less about, it's more about, oh my God, something bad could happen to me, rather than, oh, I did something wrong. Do you know what I mean?
It's the it's both.
They're both delicious and horrible.
Yeah, and you are not exempt. You would think that you would be exempt from the high school stuff because you have the real world New York stuff of right. like, oh, we got robbed. Oh, my mom's boss is dying of AIDS. All like the New York shit that yeah. you had to contend with in the 80s. But instead, you have that to contend. But you're also still a teenager.
Yeah.
And you're still like, it's killing you this girl hasn't called you back.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's killing you that you might have offended this friend.
Yeah.
And it's not like, it's not like some sort of hierarchy of needs where like, oh, I don't have time to worry about these, you know, these little social faux pas. I've got like real life and death shit. No, yeah. you're just going to worry about both.
Yeah.
Or at least I
Boy,
did.
That
at
really,
least I did.
I would have too. I would have too. I was such a hypersensitive person. I can't imagine if I had more put in front of me than I already had. I don't even know.
Yeah, it's strange and kind of exhausting.
Sure.
But yeah, it was, you know, absolutely. It's still high school.
Yeah.
And you're still, you know, you're still worried about grades and you're still worried about, being cool and indeed what that even means.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you do that thing where you keep your keys sticking out between your fingers sure. on your right hand,
which may or may not be effective. It probably
I've never had to use
more.
It. I've never actually.
What happened when you were 8?
I got shoved up against a wall, and they said, "Who's got money? Who's got money?" Which was at the time code for "Hi, I'll be your mugger today." And I turned over my wallet,
oh my
which had
God.
Like $2 and a library card
oh,
in it.
No.
And I was like, "I mean, enjoy. Here you
oh,
go." But
no.
you know. I mean, if it's just about the thrill of the kill, then you got it. But
who
you're not going to get.
How old were they? Your age, or
no? They were
like,
older. They were.
Good
but
God.
I mean, when I say older, they could have been 12 or 13.
Right. Right.
You know, I don't know.
Yay! Yay!
Yeah.
I mean, that is a sort of overblown version of the school bully. It's like life bully.
Yeah.
In a very real way, in a real circumstance, it's not in any way suspended inside.
There's
like,
the teensiest chance you can report a school bully.
That's
whose
right.
Whose name you know.
Yeah.
To the principal. But this shit is just like, what?
Oh, God. Ugh.
Yeah.
Well, and so that's, well, the, I think the key word of saying it's exhausting is like, that resonates so much because that's something that I think if you have a propensity for that above and beyond when high school ends and some of those things cling on or get worse, you
right,
know,
right.
depending on who you are and what you go through, that is the exhaustion is what I kind of remember most and almost is the thing that motivated me to like get help or to get
yeah.
out of that because it does become like the passiveness of the exhaustion leading to suicide is like so understandable
oh,
in a
yeah.
way. And I think some people think like you're just like, you know, that there's a sort of like passion to suicide, which there can be too. But I think, I mean, friends of mine that I've lost, I feel like they were just like, I'm just so tired. I remember
when I had a friend who lived in the West Beth, which is an apartment complex in like the lower West Side down near the Meatpacking District, deep West Village. And it was an artist apartment building. And
is there something called West Beth Entertainment?
Yeah.
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 Okay.
And there's a theater in the ground floor.
Yeah, there we go.
And it was always artists who lived there and they all lived in these funky little lofts. And I remember visiting them the first time. My friend was like, oh yeah, Diane Arbus killed herself here.
Holy shit.
And so that's how I found out who Diane Arbus was. And I was like, oh, all right. That's a lot for me to process as I'm 16 years old. But
yeah.
But it was the first time that it was like being at sort of a crime scene, you know, or that kind of crime scene. Because by that point, I'd walked by the Dakota, and like, this is where John Lennon was killed, yeah. And that's a whole thing. But this was like someone killed themselves here.
Yeah.
And like, what gets you there, yeah. You know? And then you look at her photos, you're like, well, she was really drawn to the really awful shit in this world, or at least the really kind of weird, depressing stuff in this world. And I think as a teenager, as a college student, I had that kind of like aloof, like, oh, you know, suicide's a coward's way out. And there is a part of me that still feels that way. But at the same time, I also understand it's like, it's just exhausting. And the fear just becomes too much.
Yeah. I think that's a great, because I get upset. I guess I don't really get that angry anymore about a lot of different points of view as I would have in the past. Right. But like, I definitely would have been the person, if we got into that argument 10 years ago, that would have refused to even see it that way, which I still sort of, I mean, I always say, like, you're using logic from the point of view of a person who can still see it that way. And that most of the time, if you're at a place where like you want to take your own life, you're not,
right.
You're not living in a place where logic and reason really exist anymore. And so I do still feel that, but I also feel like maybe that's a great way for an anxious person to view suicide, because if you didn't, then you would be kind of idealizing it. Do you know what I'm saying? And so now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, well, yeah, you know what? I've never thought about it before, but like, fuck yes. If you're a person who has anxiety and feels exhausted by anxiety or depression, but can still see suicide as a coward's way out, embrace that. Don't fall over onto that side.
Yeah, I don't romanticize, you know what I'm saying? I just have a certain amount of empathy for, like, you know, the people who've made that flawed decision, you know?
Yeah.
Good times.
I know. There was a kid, I may have mentioned this before, but there was a kid at my school who had attempted to, whether or not, I don't know the circumstances of like how much he had attempted it, i.e. was it luck that he got found, or was he going to be found because he didn't really want to?
Right.
But he had, you know, the Frankenstein stitches across his wrists.
Really?
But there was, like, there was still something. It was like around the time of Heathers, honestly, the movie Heathers.
Yeah, sure.
Like, there was this sort of, those questions I think were kind of being asked then in the same way. And I had a young listener write to me recently and tell me that she's from an area where a lot of fucked up shit has happened and a lot of people took their lives, and there was this sort of ideation happening.
Oh, there's clusters.
And there's clusters, absolutely. That sort of like mass hysteria, even in small doses. Mm. But I do remember those conversations and that confusion, because when you're kind of attracted to, you know, when you're listening to The Cure or you're listening to whatever version of that is now, you know, that there is this sort of like, how far into that darkness do you tip because you need to explore it or because that's where you are before you kind of yank yourself back out and don't go all the way down that road? And I think that's a question that we constantly keep asking generationally, as that's always going to be a thing.
Right.
Is like, there's this darkness for certain people. It comes maybe interesting to them in adolescence or in their 20s as they're emotionally developing more and like coming to understand stuff that you learned when you were 8, you know, where you're sort of like, holy shit, how do I feel about being alive? And like, how am I going to contend with some of this stuff that's really tough? And I don't know the answer to that, but like, for everyone, I'm sure it's different. But how far in do you Diane Arbus it and get right up in front of it?
Right.
And how far, and then when do you go like, I can't do that anymore, or I will start feeling like there's no point?
Well, that's, I mean, like, I'm also pretty careful about what I let into my head.
You know,
like, do you know the songwriter Vic Chestnut?
Yeah, definitely.
So Vic Chestnut killed himself a few years ago.
And
it was awful, awful, awful. And his last record is a shattering piece of work, and I've got to be in a terrific mood before that goes on.
Well, same like, with I need like to have people, Elliot Smith slip. And stuff like that, where you're.
Yeah. You know, even, I mean, Jesus Christ, he makes fucking Vic Chestnut makes Elliot Smith sound like Tom Jones. It's, that's a big,
no.
Vic Chestnut's hard. Yeah. That last record has a song about suicide called Flirted With You All My Life that is devastating.
Oh, no.
But that's a good question, though. The question you asked earlier, on a superficial level, what are the kids listening to if not The Cure, you know? Like, because when we were growing up in the 80s and you wanted to listen to, like, sad or dark music, holy shit. I mean, it was an absolute buyer's market.
Yeah, it really was.
There was Bauhaus had broken up by that point, but the Smiths were putting out records. Yeah. The Cure were putting out records.
Yeah.
And there was the deeper cut goth stuff like Sisters of Mercy and the Sex Gang Children and Liebach, if you want to get really dark.
Yeah.
And like, what are they doing now? He wonders a little. There's got to be like a goth subculture that just is not on our radar.
I think that's a great question. I don't know the answer to it. I agree with you because I know.
If your listeners write in and let you know, please keep
I
me
I do want to know. And I absolutely will. Yeah, guys, even if you just want to tweet with because I don't know. I see young people around whom, by the way, I identify with. Like, I think I look like them still. You know, I still do that thing where, like, I'll give a nod to somebody and they're like, they think I'm a soccer mom and I'm like, fuck!
Oh, dude, I'll see, like, the Latino skateboarder with the Ramones shirt on. I'm like, hey, what's up? Gabba Gabba, hey. Like, nope, don't.
Yeah, you're not welcome here. Right. You're not welcome here.
Good talk.
Yeah. I mean, it really...
the sound effect is just them rolling past me.
Yeah, I guess. Okay. No, you're right. I don't know what... I don't know what is being made anew that would fall into that category that I don't know about and think about. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's stuff that I listen to now that I don't have the same relationship to. Like, maybe it's more novel to me or it's more about the music and less about the feeling. I'm just trying to think if it's like, because, you know, you'll hear Interpol or something like that.
Oh, maybe.
There's some
yeah.
dark shit in there.
Yeah,
but
I
that's
guess
like,
so.
That's for me too. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel like it doesn't put me into the place of like I'm gonna go put on my black lipstick.
Are people like listening in their dark bedrooms the way you listen to Joy Division 30 right. years ago, who are the right. easiest antecedent to
or
Interpol?
Are you listening to Joy? Like, or is that something that is because there isn't really that version of the 1960s or, you know, the beginning of the 1970s, obviously in the later 70s, you do get kind of more into like angry punk rock or CBGB stuff
yeah.
or, you know, but like, was that a product of its time to the point where you are sort of embracing that the same way rockabilly would be embracing a lot of old music? Are goths listening to old Cure and
maybe
old Smith
it.
And old Depeche
maybe they're
Mode
like
and hanging on to
the Deadheads when I was in high school
yeah.
who were listening
who,
to...
Who, by the way, there are still, you
there
know,
are still
Deadheads.
There are still Deadheads.
Yeah. That's a good question, though. It's a really good question.
I wonder if it's just a completely retro movement now
yeah.
or if there's, like, new stuff.
How sad that... I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be, like, a version of Tori Amos.
There
right? But I don't know who
be,
that is.
Right?
It's not like... Because it's not like...
It's not Regina Spektor.
It's what I was going to say. She's like too upbeat.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's funny because I Jamie, my wife, never had a Smiths phase and for whatever reason. And I'm always like, oh, I should, you know, I should sit her down and play Queen is Dead. But you had to be there. You
yeah,
know?
I don't know if that's
I'm not
going
to introduce a woman who is, she'll kill me for saying this, who is in her very early 40s, to the Smiths. I just don't think that's going to connect me. I heard the Smiths when Sybil Arrisman played them for me in her West Village apartment that she shared with her two moms.
Amazing.
And that was like exactly how she put on Reel Around the Fountain. And that's exactly how you're supposed to be introduced to the Smiths.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's textbook how we teach someone about the Smiths. And yeah. I don't know if you could... Like, here, take a break from raising your children and listen to the headmaster ritual. See if this clicks with you.
Yeah, that's a really good point. God, for to have that sort of, like, stuff reflected back to you, too. I mean, you have the kind of, like, I didn't grow up in a place that constantly gets depicted in movies and film. Mm. Movies and film, like, they're different. Well, they kind of are. Sometimes things are just movies, not film. No, but, like, you know, to see stuff reflect back in television and stuff. I mean, was that something that you look at now and sort of go, yeah, a lot of that's right? Or I guess there's so many different versions of what you see.
So
but it's so interesting to see that reflected back.
Yeah.
In a way that I just never, you know, most of us, I'm sure that's why everyone's so curious, is that we have this idea of New York based on what we saw depicted rather than, you know, it's like, oh, Woody Allen's New York. Oh, Taxi Driver New York. Oh, Whit Stillman New York, you know.
Whit Stillman New York. Yeah, well, it's all true, you know. It's a huge place.
Yeah.
you know, it's I mean, they always say it's a city of 8 million people. I think it's closer to 10 now. And it's sprawling, and it changes on a dime. And it doesn't change as abruptly as like LA or DC does, where you'll be like walking through a really nice neighborhood, you'll turn, and you're like, oh shit, what happened? Yeah. New York is it's a much more gradual thing. But I remember, like, well, getting back to your question, yes, you know, there is a lot of accuracy to Taxi Driver. You know what is weirdly accurate, speaking of Scorsese, but underrated Scorsese, is After Hours.
Oh,
and
yeah.
After God, Hours I loved After hits Hours. Something very interesting and very specific about, and it's kind of a... It's a very judgmental movie in a lot of ways. It's very much like, you know, we're the normals, and right below 14th Street is this seething underbelly, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember Roger Ebert would write about, like, all the steam that's coming up from the manholes in that movie and how it was like hell lurks just underneath.
Sure,
and
sure.
And that's, I think that's a real conscious image, you know?
Yeah.
But I remember the first time I took a cab down to visit my new friends, my new bohemian friends who lived... I was going down to Christopher Street, and I felt very much like Griffin Dunne in that movie.
Yeah.
And I got there, and they're like, is it okay? Did your $20 bill fly out the window? I'm like, no, no, it's fine. I'm very comfortable around here. What's what's happening now? Yeah, why are you guys all reading on the road?
Alice in Wonderland, I guess it really is. Like,
yeah.
Very much so that.
But yeah, there's stuff about, you know, the stuff, the New York films that are made by New Yorkers are very accurate. The New York films that are not made by New
Can you smell them a mile away as you're watching it? You're like, no, yeah, hang on.
Yeah. You know, I remember there was I was watching My Dinner with Andre one time, and there's a shot of Wallace Shawn on the subway. And it's the subway in 1982 or whatever. And I remember I had this very specific memory of, like, my mom had to tell me as a little tiny kid to not put my mouth on the hand pole in the subway.
Yeah.
She, like, that had to be explained to me in this graffiti strewn subway car that, no, don't put your mouth on this thing. So that's weird. What annoys New Yorkers, and this is a popular thing that is discussed, is when people come and they fuck up the geography. And if you've ever seen Luc Besson's The Professional, Terry Gilliam's The Fisher King, they run roughshod over what happens, where everything
Agreed.
Is in New York.
And I think that's I feel the exact same way about San Francisco, which is like
San Francisco
a very
is
film
it's
thing
mangled.
Where I'm like, what? Why are they? Yeah, it's really easy to sort
Have
of
you seen
become.
Bullet?
Yeah.
Bullet is accurate, right?
Yeah,
Bullet
Bullet's
seems
pretty,
to honor the geography
accurate,
and
yeah.
the whole car chase.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. yeah it is. You're absolutely right. There's and almost everything else that's contemporary is just absolutely like will make you crazy if you pay any attention at all.
I'm sure.
So
that's
funny.
So interesting.
And then sometimes in LA, I feel that way. I mean, I'll see something and I'll be like, no, hold on.
Well, it's funny.
You were just in Griffith Park. How are you in Venice?
Yeah, totally. I there's a moment in Clueless where Dan Hedaya yells at Alisa Silverstone, like, I'll see you in 20 minutes. 20 minutes. Everywhere. It takes everywhere to get from one place to another in LA. It takes 20 minutes. I'm like, that's factually untrue. Even at that time
couldn't,
of night, I'm not buying that.
Couldn't be more untrue. Yeah.
I'm not buying that. Even at
we're
that time of night.
Not falling for that bullshit.
Falsehood.
Yeah.
What, she could take Laurel Canyon? Because fuck that. It takes one accident to shut that whole thing down.
Yeah.
I find myself yelling at the TV.
Well, that's kind of an interesting, I guess that's a conversation for another podcast, probably someone else's, but just that whole relationship to, you know, feels like there's so many artists living in Los Angeles. There are so many artists living in New York that of course you're going to see those worlds depicted for one reason or another, whether it's practicality shooting in California because
right.
you know, you're going to or whatever, but that the relationship to the place itself seems most of the time so much more incidental to stuff set in LA and in New York. It is this sort of extra character,
yes,
right?
It's
this
definitely.
Like you really, the textural richness of that ends up creeping in and becomes this huge part of what makes the movie set in New York,
very
opposed
much so.
To like Los Angeles, you know, unless you're a movie like LA Story or even maybe Clueless where you're sort of like, you are kind of satirizing things that everyone sort of has this universal eye roll understanding about LA, but
it's a broader version of that. Yeah. When did you move to LA?
I've been here for almost 11 years now.
Okay.
And it blows my mind.
Have you seen Swingers since you moved here?
Have I seen Swingers since I moved here? I don't think I have.
You'd remember.
I mean, I know the area code thing. I can remember now. I can look back and know things mean something different to me now. And the Brown Derby being like near where I live and all that.
Right.
But I should watch it again because I don't know if I've seen it.
It's a documentary.
Yeah.
On a number of levels.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the swing stuff is all super dated, but all the other little details about the way they talk about like the acting bullshit in this town is so specific.
I need to rewatch
it. It's worth watching again. Yeah. I always recommend it when people move to LA. It's like, you know what you're going to get now for the first time?
Yeah.
Like, really get is Swingers.
Well, I did feel that way even about LA Story, which was like 1992 or something like that.
Yeah.
Still, so much of it is like,
he drives down to the mailbox and then comes back up. Yeah.
I don't know. We could walk. And he just starts laughing. walk in LA. That's so sad. So terribly sad. All right. I got to get into this MASH game, but I'm very excited to do so. I feel like I am, I customize these categories as much as I can.
Okay.
I'm sure everyone listening is like, now hold on. You really lean into the same like six, but I'm not going to give you something I don't think is going to mean anything to you, but I feel like we really covered a lot of ground. So I'm going to start with, hopefully you'll enjoy this. You can go into the world of three set in New York movies.
Oh, okay.
And they're real. So you sort of you can experience the blank version of New York and blank version of New York whenever you want to, for whatever reason you want to.
Okay.
Three
movies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'm actually, believe it or not, I'm going to go with Taxi Driver because I never got to go on to the Deuce when I was a kid.
There you go. So get it in the most intense way.
I'm going to go in there and I'm going to catch some Kung Fu triple features.
Great.
And I'm just going to keep everyone from, make sure everyone keeps their hands to themselves. I'm my age, right? I'm not a kid doing this. I'm going in this age.
Correct.
I'm going into that
you
world.
You into Great. That world.
Okay. I lived through Hannah and Her Sisters, so I don't know if we can really count that, but that was a nice
film. I was obsessed with that movie in high school.
That movie's just a travelogue. There's a whole part of that movie where they just stop for a second and go, hey, would you like to see some of my favorite buildings?
Yes, you're absolutely right. You're
and
absolutely right.
Sam Waterston takes him around, just shows him on this little easy, and it's just Midtown Manhattan because, you know, Woody is Woody. But it's just like a little
two-minute
travelogue.
It's kind of like the beginning of Midnight in Paris, where it's just like, oh, this is just 10 minutes of a video about Paris. You know, looking at it.
So, you know, I'll back up because I was only about six when Annie Hall came out. So I'll pick That's Annie great. Hall instead of that. So Taxi Driver, Annie Hall, which I think are within a couple of years of each other.
Great. And so desperate. It's great.
And then I'll do Cassavetes' Shadows.
Okay.
Which is like 60, 62, somewhere in there. It took years to shoot, but that's like a really interesting part of
I haven't seen that many Cassavetes movies. I feel like I tried to watch them too early and was like, I get that this is like, you guys all have some great like inside click and you got a whole thing and I don't know what it is.
You need to go see them in a theater. And you'll have the chance. It's L.A., you know. Yeah. You'll have a chance to see him on the big screen. But if you sit down and try to rent Women Under the Influence, you're going to get a little antsy and you're going to get up. And it's also a really uncomfortable movie to watch.
Yeah.
You watch Jenna Rollins basically lose her shit for 2.5 hours.
I think that is the
only
movie I've seen.
It's totally worth seeing. Yeah. But try to go see it at a theater. Like if the New Beverly does a double feature, like sit your ass down.
Well, now I want to see Shadows.
And Shadows is cool because it's New York. It was just Cassavetes and a bunch of his actor friends from an acting class.
Yeah.
And they got together. Let's make a movie. How do you do that? I don't fucking know. Here we go. And it's very raw and meandering.
Yeah.
And there's like this kind of shoehorned thing about race relations. It's fascinating.
I wonder what I would I feel like I would throw Manhattan itself in there. It is in black and white, and it would be so interesting and different. But that's one of those movies, I'm sure I've said this on the podcast before, or maybe not, but that's one of those movies where I can come back to it 5 years 10 years, whatever, and it's like almost a different movie to me. Like whatever resonates for me is different. There's a different piece of it that like haunts me. Like, oh, you know, when as a young person, I think I was like, oh, I have this sort of I think I was like, oh, the appeal of being with an older man and the sort of like getting a peek inside of like grown up world. And that was always the fascination with Woody Allen movies anyway. Right. You know, and that sort of intellectual elitism and all that kind of stuff. And then like, being, you know, seeing it 10 years later and being like, oh my God, I really can connect with, you know, this character or this thing that happens.
Yeah.
I don't know why
like it just feels like that the particular layers for that movie to me are very resonant in
a very different
way. It's probably
the hardest one to watch now in hindsight, knowing all we do,
yeah,
all that is alleged, but it is a beautiful piece of work.
Yeah.
I mean, it is gorgeous to look at.
Yeah.
It really is so painterly in the way it shows the city.
Mm-hmm.
And the music is all Gershwin and all great. And then there's these wonderful little moments of like, it's that movie and Hannah where he plays a writer on a sketch comedy show.
That's right.
It's clearly supposed to be SNL.
That's right.
And he's so frustrated with the gig, but yeah, he's still kind of drawn to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why no journalist has ever kind of held his feet to the fire. Like, what's your, like, are you interested in sketch comedy? Why yeah. are you, why do we not talk about this more?
Yeah.
But yeah, Manhattan's a beautiful piece of work. Right after we moved here, we saw Manhattan and Annie Hall at a double feature at the New Beverly, which, if you're not in LA, is this terrific revival house in Hollywood that is actually now owned by Tarantino. And the so we it was we'd moved here in January, maybe March or April. We took our friend Will Burson, who had moved just a few months before us, and we went to go see Annie Hall and Manhattan and then stepped out onto the street lined with palm trees. And we're like, oh, fuck, we might have made a horrible mistake.
Absolutely.
This might have been the worst possible thing to do right now.
You did all right.
Yeah.
You did all right. Okay. Next category is going to be you can see at your leisure, at your discretion, and as often as you want, a band or like a singer-songwriter that for whatever reason now you probably wouldn't have the opportunity to do. It's just like at any night, in any time, you could be like, you know what? Let's just – I'm going to go around the corner and see blah, blah, blah.
You know what? Who I never got to see, and there's such an 80s band, and there's such an 80s LA band.
Yeah.
And I remember they came to New York, but I was at summer camp. And I was unable to go see them.
Mm-hmm.
Oingo Boingo.
Oh,
I never
that's
saw
great.
Oingo Boingo live. And
that's great.
I loved those guys. And I still go back to those records occasionally. There's a record called Nothing to Fear. So I think I'd see them on that tour.
It's a great choice. Great choice.
And I would see them at the Ritz on 11th Street, which is now Webster Hall.
Love it. Love it.
That's first thing that comes to my mind, but I'm sticking to it.
Okay, good. And now I need two more. I don't know how you're going to top that. Oh, you don't need to top that.
See, the nice thing about living in New York is that, you know, your favorite band will show up. So I got to see a lot of people.
What about a show you wish you could – I'll expand this category too to like, I wish I could see that again now. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it would be fun to be able to like – there are a couple of shows I saw that were so great. It would be fun to be able to like kind of jettison back to them, I think.
And maybe see it like with fresh eyes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder. Well, it would have been interesting to see one of those Ramones shows at CB's when they were still arguing with each other on stage.
There you go.
That would have been really fun, I think.
Absolutely.
And I got to see the Ramones a few times when they were playing larger theaters. And it was before Dee Dee left, but they were a machine by that point. They were coming out, they'd do like a 55-minute set of, you know, 40-something songs.
Right, right.
And it was amazing. And you sweat, your eyeballs sweat. It was just the most intense thing.
Yeah.
But it would have been interesting to see like one of those shows at CB's where they still had the tables set up at CB's with the candles and like watch them bickering up on stage.
Absolutely.
That would have been really interesting. Because again, I'm like, yes, I grew up in New York, but I'm not old enough to have like... They were really strict about carding, so I didn't get into CB's till 1987.
Yeah. I would have loved to have seen, like, did you see Talking Heads?
No.
I'd have loved to have seen Talking Heads.
Yeah, Talking Heads would have
been
great,
too. Or, like, The Police. Like, young, hungry The Police.
Yeah. There's a famous story about them getting all their equipment stolen at CB's.
Oh,
actually,
wow.
On their first American tour. Oh, that would have been interesting to see them right before all that stuff got ripped off. What else would have been cool to see? You know, I took care of a lot of bucket list
Good
stuff. Like, I've seen Dylan. I've seen... I saw The Dead with Brett Midland, who was only their second Dead keyboardist. what else would it be? Oh, it would have been neat to see, like, one of the... see, like one of the punk rock shows around here down on the strip, like at the Starwood or when the Whiskey was still booking punk rock or that Ukrainian social club on Melrose.
Yeah.
Like East Melrose.
Yeah.
That place was like home to a bunch of Black Flag shows.
Oh,
and
I
stuff.
Didn't know that. That's funny.
That would have been. Yeah, because that's a really interesting era of punk rock. The whole L.A. scene in the early 80s, because it's angrier than the British stuff. And it's starting to discover pop hooks a little bit more, you know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And so it's a really interesting era of like Black Flag and X and the Germs. And that would have been a really, need to see one of those bills in like, I'm missing one of the places. There was the Starwood, there was the Ukrainian, the Whiskey, but there's another place that there's somebody sitting in their car screaming at their radio. Like, you mean the blank?
Yeah.
But one of those gigs. Okay. So I'll say Black Flag at the Ukrainian social club.
Great one. Perfect. Okay. Okay. Next category will be got to go with the MASH perennial classic, three vacation homes. But it could also be totally fictitious, non-existent places that you would see in like movies or like Middle Earth or whatever. You certainly could.
No, it's even I own. Even I must draw a line. It's a wretched hive of scum after all. I'd love something up in the Bay Area. I'm not just saying that to flatter you. And
we accept your flattery.
Every time my wife and I go up there, we're just like, God, if we could do what we do and live up here. Man,
I know. I still feel that way.
Yeah.
I mean, for sure.
Here's the problem with me is that I am really comfortable in cities. So everyone's idea of a vacation home is like,
I don't like sitting on a beach either. No, I like an amble. I would want to be in a place where I could still go to like a museum and sit in a cafe and, you know, I still want all that.
Yeah. It would be cool to have one of those like English country homes about an hour and a half outside of London.
There you go.
That would be nice.
There you go.
So you could dip in and see some theater.
Yeah. Great.
Get back on the M1. I need a third. Just to really like cool my jets, and because it would be good for me to. Oh, you know what? It's so cold though. I went to school at Ithaca College. And that area is beautiful. The Finger Lakes.
You don't have to go there when it's cold. It's your place. You can go whenever you want.
Yeah, summertime by Lake Cayuga. Ithaca is a really lovely little town.
Love it. Okay.
Actually, you know who I met while I was in Ithaca? I met Andy Secunda, who's another native Manhattanite.
Another native guy. I haven't seen Andy in so long.
It's Andy Hardig, Andy Secunda. Who else are the people I know who actually grew up? Will Burson, who I mentioned earlier, he grew up right near in like Lenox, Morningside Heights, kind of right near Columbia. But yeah, there's a lot of New Yorkers just kind of stay there.
Yeah.
They're like, listen, I'm in everyone's destination home. I'm just going to stay put.
No, know? I get it. I mean, I'm some people sit on say this that rent about stabilized LA apartment, too. You know? I'm like, you can have 60 different versions of LA without ever leaving LA. You can move and have different jobs and like keep having a weird, renewed, different experience here.
Totally.
Okay, next category is three things that aren't great for you, but in this alternate universe, they are. And that could be specific kinds of food or drinks or activities, anything like that. That's like, I'm not going to indulge in that to a great degree here and now, but great if this didn't had you know, any kind of bad effect.
First thing that comes to my mind is a buddy of mine, another New Yorker who I met at college, a guy named Ed Sargent, posted on Facebook this morning a bacon-wrapped grilled cheese sandwich.
There you go. Gorgeous.
Let me explain that. That is a grilled cheese sandwich that has been wrapped in bacon.
Oh, man. Like, is any of the sandwich showing through the bacon?
No. Funny you should ask. It just looks like a bacon brick, but then you cut it open and there's bread and cheese in there.
Great. Yeah. Bacon, perfect. This is a perfect use of this category.
Yeah.
Two more.
You know, I quit drinking a few years ago, and I don't really miss it because I've gotten so bad at it, but it would be great if I could get white wine drunk the way I did in my mid-20s.
There you go.
Where I would just be like, euphoric for 4 hours, go to sleep, wake up with a headache, and then boom, Coke and two Advil, and I'm right as rain.
You know?
If I could bounce back like that, that would be great. By the time I quit drinking, that was not the situation at all.
Same.
Did you quit as well?
Well, I did. I mean, I have not officially quit, but I have not done it so much that like now,
right.
one, I was I expressed great pride in myself for finishing a vodka soda in New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
I was like, I had one whole drink.
Wow.
And no everyone kidding. Else in the cast was like, you're an asshole. We've had seven and we're fine. But yeah, because it did become, it's like the narrowing of categories of things that I feel okay after has gotten so small. Up to and including red wine. It's like now with red wine, I'll either get stuffed up immediately or like fall asleep and then 3 hours later I'll wake up with like heartburn and a sense of like, oh, something's horribly wrong, like just emotionally.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, the heartburn is another thing. That's like the lamest reason to quit drinking. But I was like, then the acid reflux, it's unpleasant.
I love this. I love the bacon wrapped sandwich. I love the white wine drunk. I just need one more.
In my 20s, white wine drunk.
Yes.
Circa 96.
Yeah.
Another thing that I wish I could do, all things not, you know, I my knees are not great, but I always soccer looks fun.
Yeah. And oh, you know what? Like, I'll save that. I'm going to save that for a category of like sort of activities.
Oh, okay. Great. Yeah. Okay. So, in that case, you know those enormous bags of kettle corn?
Yeah, it is.
That you get at a farmer's market?
Oh.
Those really enormous ones? The ones that are like, come up to your waist?
Oh, yes.
I'd like to just...
Garbage bag full.
Kill that.
You know what? I agree, because I will say, I will volunteer that I think popcorn is the best example of a thing that you can eat way too much of and your stomach doesn't tell you you're done.
Yeah.
And then also has the worst impact.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm eating sugar... Halfway through, I start to already feel like, all right, I should stop this.
Yeah, I gotta wrap
this up. But with popcorn, I'm like, good, I am good to go, everybody. Yeah. And then, like, the drop off is so immediate and so, like,
Yeah.
But a lot of stuff can be eaten before that happens. Oh, yeah.
You can do some real damage before you suddenly realize you've hurt yourself.
Yeah.
It's like getting drunk at a Seder where you're just sitting there. this is why people think I'm Jewish. But like getting really loaded at a Seder and you're like, oh, it's another plague. Drink, another plague. Drink. And then you stand up. You're like, oh, my God.
I've made a horrible,
how did I get so shit house?
Yeah.
How did I get so shit house on Passover?
Okay. Great. Next category will be three activities that cause no physical pain whatsoever that suddenly you wake up tomorrow and you're just amazing at.
Oh, okay. I'd love to be a great soccer player.
Great.
I would like to jump out of a plane.
Great.
And I'd like to be a better, it would be fun to be a better dancer.
Oh, agreed, for me too. Now I just revel in dancing poorly. Like I lean into like, it's more fun now for me to like joke around and like mime activities. Like I'm baking cookies dancing than it is for me to like really get into it.
What's she doing? She's cracking the egg. She's cracking the egg, guys.
I get it's good. It's really good space work.
Phenomenal.
It's really, really good
phenomenal.
Space work.
Phenomenal.
Oh boy. Okay. Next category is, all due respect to your beautiful wife. This is an alternate universe where you can have some sexy times.
Okay.
Or alternate universe wife, whatever you want, with three people. Ideally, we know who they are, but it doesn't have to be from this era. It could be young Audrey Hepburn. Could be Debbie Harry, whatever.
Okay. Wow. Goodness gracious.
Good luck whittling that down to three.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, why is Nico popping up in my head right now?
I think it makes sense for everything we've been talking about.
Maybe Nico. Hang on. Don't write that down.
She seems so
She doesn't seem
bland.
Like she'd be a lot of fun, though. Yeah. You know? She, I mean, she's
what do you want to do now?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I'm not concerned. People. this is my Bielstein. I will. Oh, my goodness. I just got Facebooked by a girl I had a crush on. This is crazy. I'm not going to say her name, but that's bananas. Look
that
at that.
A very weird coincidence.
Weird. That's a junior high. I actually, now that I think of it, played 7 minutes in the closet with this young lady.
Ooh.
And or however long you're in the closet for. And that might have been the first other person's tongue I had in my mouth. Well, hello.
That's exciting. Hello,
you. I'm going to make you wait for it. Oh, I should Facebook him. He's on TV. No, you're going to wait for it a little bit, sweetheart. Three women from another time. All right. With all due respect to my lovely bride. No, but all other things being equal.
Yeah.
Well, you know, because I'm nothing if not loyal, and frankly, she still looks great.
Yeah.
Still Winona Ryder. Right. I don't care. Especially because she's crazy.
Okay, great.
One of the first things I saw her getting her prescription filled at the Rite Aid on Fairfax and Sunset right after I moved here, and I was just like, Los Angeles. That was phenomenal. Getting her prescription filled. This was at the height of the shoplifting scandal, too. It was a home run celebrity sighting.
My version of that, which makes far less sense but was as delightful for me, was right when I moved here. I saw Peter Falk get an ice cream cone, and he was wearing a denim jacket or like a denim shirt with a giant embroidered bald eagle on the back.
That's and glorious.
He ate the ice cream. See, we were sitting out, I think it was with Cole. We were sitting outside. And we watched him sit and eat the ice cream, and then he went inside and got another ice cream cone.
Because he's fucking Peter Falk.
Because he's fucking Peter Falk.
You know what he's not thinking of? Like, oh, I shouldn't. Yeah. No, he's just in there.
I want another ice cream. Yeah, it was great. But I don't even know. I mean, that's not as, like, iconic as...
It's pretty cool, though. Yeah. Again, watch Woman Under the Influence to see a great Peter Falk performance. Okay, so Winona. Who's the woman in... In performance. Is that Anita Ekberg? Hang on one second.
Ooh, this is getting good. Performance? Is that... What's that?
It's a James Fox, Mick Jagger movie where Mick plays a reclusive rock star.
I've never even heard of it, I don't think.
Nicholas Rogue, I want to say, is the director.
Oh, yeah. You know what's going to sound incredibly nerdy? Mm. Nicholas Rogue is quite often a crossword clue for the New York Times crossword
puzzle. I bet he is. Unusual four-letter names usually are, yeah.
Yeah.
Hang on one second.
That was very satisfying for me to be able to pull. Like, if I can't pull an actual understanding of his work, at least I can reference him as a crossword clue.
Well, Rogue is really common, and then three-letter fish, Roe, comes up a lot,
too.
You're
absolutely right.
Remember, Will Short's specialty.
The most surprising one I've ever seen that got me the most excited to where I actually stood up, like, in surprise and like cried out was Greg Barrett was a crossword clue one time.
Really?
And like he's the best guy in the world. But I was like funny man blank Barrett and I was like, ah!
That's so great.
It was so cool.
My friend Anna Ortiz was on Ugly Betty. She's got her crossword mentioned.
I think I remember
framed.
That too.
She's got
it's
it
great.
Framed in her house.
It's great.
Because you know it's ANA, so anytime there's those little three letter things
and it was
Ugly Maid star blank Ortiz and we were just so when I first met her, we were doing a series together. And we used to do the New York Times crossword puzzle together. So when she got that, I know that's the best ever. I think she was in performance. Anita Ekberg. Look her up. I know that name. Yeah, she was like she's like that perfect 60s voluptuous. Mm-hmm, like good lord.
I'm sure. I have a picture in my mind. I bet it's her.
1960 Kim Novak.
Oh great, great. Yeah, that's another one where you
which
sort of
I've
go,
just
holy
completely
smokes.
Like really just I mean it's just shameless how boob centric that list is. I'm done pretending.
I mean, it's okay. I'm glad it happened here. Oh, that's true. I hadn't really thought about that. It really is boob centric.
Yes, sure is.
God, yeah. I remember having so many thoughts to myself about Winona, which I understood even then, like, I know she's not a normal, like, trying to figure out, because I've never met her, trying to figure out the math in my head of, well, I know she's a very small person, so what size are her boobs in comparison to mine when I'm a normal size person?
Right.
Like, what if she just has, like, not very big, because everyone thought she had such big boobs, but I was like, but she's so small, you guys, it might be that she just has normal size boobs on a tiny body.
Good question. But it's all
proportion.
That's
what comes from being in the limelight, is people wondering about your proportions
and
how they relate to real life.
I think she got accused of having work done, but I think that's just her.
I think so, too. I mean, I only ever remember her even as a young teenager having boobs.
You can tell her in Heathers, and she's 17 in Heathers. And
agreed.
You can tell that it's there.
Yeah, and in Mermaids, too.
Oh, Mermaids, right. Yeah, and I think even in Beetlejuice, although she's all
wearing
dressed in black and the whole goth thing.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
I haven't looked carefully enough in Lucas, but I'll rewatch. I'll go back into Lucas.
I need to do that research. Okay. I've got two final categories. This next category is going to be three people, three creators of some kind, could be them artists, directors, musicians, whatever, that is from any era that are like your bud. Like three people that you're like, I can't believe David Bowie just called John Rosbaum. You know, like, it's cool. I was just like around the corner with blah, 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 like having a beer.
Oh, there's something so otherworldly about Bowie that I don't know that I could.
I know,
I
he's probably
friends
not
with him, you know? Yeah. There's something just so like, he's one of those guys where anytime you hear him give an interview, like, oh, you speak like a normal person.
Yeah.
You don't speak, you don't have like a built-in echo and reverb. Yeah. When you talk.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys. Hendrix is one of those guys. Yeah. And Bob Marley are one of those guys where anytime you hear an interview with them and they're just speaking.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, you just talk like
you're
a person. That's it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like all those people I mentioned I admire, but I don't know that I'd want to be friends with them.
Yeah. This is like a chum.
This is going to sound super pretentious, but I'm going to make a couple quick points before.
Okay.
The guy I'm going to say is one of those directors that people are always pointing out as like, that's, you know, master of cinema. But if you read interviews, he didn't really speak English, but if you read interviews, he's actually a down-to-earth, cool guy who wanted to make entertaining movies.
Okay.
And did so, but it would have been cool to have, A, been fluent in Japanese and be friends with Akira Kurosawa.
Great. That's not pretentious.
Anytime, but obviously that peak year of like 50 to 60, where it's like Seven Samurai and Rashomon and Yojimbo and that whole run of like really fun samurai movies that are actually really, they're like, you know, they're film school must-haves, but they're actually really accessible, entertaining movies considering they're 60-year-old Japanese black and white films. So Akira Kurosawa,
it's
put
great.
On there.
It's great, great, great.
It would have been, it would, I don't know why this is popping into my head. I heard an amazing Walter Matthau story the other day.
Oh my God, I would totally, I think that would be a great person.
And Matthau's interesting because there was that run there in the 60s and 70s where Matthau was a leading man.
Mm-hmm.
And like critics who,
unlikely.
There was a critic who said he has a face like an unmade bed. And
he looks like a Shar Pei.
He does.
He's so great.
But I think it would have been cool to be friends with Walter Matthau.
I love it.
The story I heard was that he and his wife, who it was not a Hollywood marriage, they were together for like 50 years. Yeah. She buried him. You know, they were together for a really long time. But as such, they would have these arguments, and they were touring Poland one time, and they had this really gnarly fight in the morning, and they had a tour scheduled at Auschwitz.
Oh my God.
So they go to Auschwitz and they're not speaking to each other, and they get back in the car and she starts the fight again, and he turns to her and goes, "You ruined Auschwitz." And I just heard that story from my friend Leslie Grossman a couple days ago, and I died laughing at that story. So I think I would want to be friends with Walter Matthau.
I'm pleased because we finally got the word Auschwitz into this podcast episode, and it took too long considering that you're married to Jamie Denbo.
Oh, I know.
That came up within 15 minutes.
No, that's my girl.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny, you know, and she talked about it on your show, too. I mean, she has this thing, and I have this thing, and this is something, okay, you want to hear another reason why people think I'm Jewish? Because what Jamie and I have in common is that neither of us can remember a time when we didn't know about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And that's growing up Jewish and growing up in New York.
Yep.
Like, I do not remember a time, I don't know,
being
I don't remember being
about
explained
it. Exactly
what the Holocaust was.
Exactly.
I just remember, and I don't know who did it.
Yeah.
I don't, it's probably my dad, but I don't know who provided me with this information.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, Auschwitz can't be ruined. And
amazing.
The third person. I don't know. What do people say?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of.
Is this a recurring? Do you use it all the time?
I don't use it all the time. Sometimes people just go for the gusto, and they're just like Gandhi, Obama, blah blah blah.
Right.
I always say.
Oh, I bet Obama and I would.
I would always. I mean, you probably would. I always say like, I love Emma Thompson. I wish you were my best friend.
Oh, Emma Thompson would be cool to be friends with.
I mean, you can take her if you want her.
Emma Thompson really would be cool to be friends with. Am I going to go with Emma Thompson? I think I am.
You really can, because she's the coolest person in the world.
She's the coolest
person. She's not the person that pops in everyone's mind, but then once you say it, you're like, oh, fuck, she really
is. No, I'm a fan. I'm a total fan. And there is actually recorded proof of a record I cut. My old band, we cut a record where there was a spoken word part. And I remember very specifically... it was the sort of fantasy sequence where the guy in the sauna has his dream car, and he's got Emma Thompson in the car with him. So
okay, all right,
recording,
you know what?
Proof.
You
I come
got
by it,
it
honestly.
You got it. Then I'm happy to donate her.
We're sharing her.
We'll share her.
This is like
that's true. I'll be coming over all the time. What am I worried about? This is great. Okay, and then final category will be for you.
God, what is left? I feel like I've covered so much good territory. Let's go superpowers.
Oh, wow.
For your superpowers.
Superpowers. I would love to fly. I know everyone says that, but I really would like to fly.
There's a reason, because it would be fucking awesome.
Right. And it would be cool to I'd like a power where, like, they give you – you're not in L.A., right?
Yep.
You're somewhere in the middle of the country, and you order an iced coffee, and they give it to you, and you can see through it. And yes. It's not a straw in iced coffee. I want the power to, like, just be able to shoot a shot of espresso into it with my finger.
Okay.
Just red-eye it. Just bang.
Great. Great, 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 great.
Just shoot it into opacity.
Yeah.
And then, like, that's a fucking cup of iced coffee there. Not this fucking iced tea you're throwing at me. Goddamn hillbilly.
There you go. There so, you go. Yeah,
flying, shooting espresso from my fingers.
It's hard because some of them are like,
you don't want to say invisibility because that always sounds creepy.
I mean, yeah, it's like, what do you do with that? It's like a cool thing, but how does that get used? Some with like ESP stuff is like, how do you not?
Oh, I don't want
ESP. You know what I'm saying?
I don't want ESP.
I will tell you now that I've also offered up Emma, I would also go with super speed because I do think it would be really fun to be able to just like zip all over the place. You know? Wouldn't it be satisfying if you were on the ground and you were just like, maybe not.
That seems like the ideal way for me to run into something.
Response.
That seems like an ideal way for me to break my nose. That
is coming from someone who wants to be on a bike all the time because biking is faster than running. So the idea of like being able to run as fast as I bike is very appealing. It makes perfect sense that that would hold zero. Like that it would hold the same, not hold the same appeal.
I'm thinking again as a New Yorker of like me going right into a lamppost.
So true though. I would.
I mean, I did that. I ran into a lamppost when I was a kid and cut my head open on dinner with my dad. And he had like, we had Thursday night dinners after the divorce. And I remember I walked down, they used to have those little tiny police call boxes on the lamppost. And I cut my head open on that and had to get us in, you know, bled like a stuck pig. It was horrible. I'm sitting there in like, the Roosevelt Hospital emergency room. So that's – and that was me just walking normal speed. So super speed, that would just happen all the time. No, fair, veto the
fair,
super
fair,
speed.
Fair,
vetoing
fair,
the super speed.
Very fair. What about like healing kind of stuff?
I'd like a healing power. I'd love a healing power would be great. Yeah. I was thinking – I was just thinking of – I think it's Swamp Thing who can do that.
Then you'd have to look like Swamp Thing. Nope, not you.
No, I just have a superpower. Hold on. Deal breaker.
That's correct. No, you do not have to look like Swamp Thing.
I just think that would be fun. Because, you know, my kids stub their toes or skin their knees. I'd love to be able to like, zoop, you're all better.
Take it away. I think it's great. Okay, great. All right. Now all I need is just my means by which I will figure out which of these you end up with. So tell me when to stop.
Stop.
Okay. I'm going to pause this. Do a little bit of... I don't know what you call this. Sometimes I say calculating. There's no math involved.
Okay.
I will come back with your 100% guaranteed MASH future.
Okay.
I want to reassure the listener, 160 episodes or so in, you know that it will seem as if no time has passed for you. I need to go down on record as well saying that I think your reasoning and the stories behind all of the choices that you made are some of my all-time favorites in any game of MASH I've played.
Oh, that's nice you to say.
That was like it could have been its own separate episode. There was so much great stuff in there. And listen, you got some great results. There's a kind of wide, disparate series of things going on, which I think is great because you're experiencing all kinds of different stuff. Number one, I got to get this out of here right away. You are a fantastic soccer player.
Oh, great.
I think that's very pleasing.
Good. That's nice.
But not only can you play soccer like a champ, you can also fly.
Oh, good.
I mean, I hope that that doesn't like sully
FIFA rules, but then again, their rules are pretty shaky anyway.
Yeah,
so.
I don't. If you're running swiftly and people aren't really realizing that your feet aren't touching the ground, I think maybe you can somehow get away with it. Yeah. It's very easy for me to imagine you sort of at practice and or enjoying time with your teammates in the Bay Area, which is where you have a beautiful apartment.
Right.
Which I think is fantastic. You can also, if you need a break from that or from LA, you can dip right into the world of shadows.
Oh, great. Good.
Very exciting. And that seems like the kind of experience that you would want to talk about with your very good friend, Mr. Kurosawa.
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Really good.
I'd probably call him sensei even though we're friends, but yeah.
Sure. I mean, he would probably. It would be like a little wink, wink, nudge, maybe nudge, sensei. Kind of thing, yeah. It'd be like, it started out as a joke, but now I actually call him sensei.
Right, right.
You have also seen a very early Ramon show.
Right.
And I don't know if you saw that with your beautiful alternate universe girlfriend, Kim Novak, circa 1960s.
Good.
But certainly you spend as much time with her as you would like and eat as many bacon-covered grilled cheese sandwiches as you can possibly stomach.
Yeah, I had a feeling that one was going to make the cut.
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it.
Good.
This is good. Really good stuff.
That's
a lot to look forward to.
That's a lot to look forward to. Yeah. That's a good life.
Yeah. That's a life of excess.
It is.
By anyone's standards.
It is. But the soccer is going to help a lot.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Thank you so much for doing the podcast.
Jenna, what a pleasure
and a joy.
What a total pleasure.
Oh my God. It was a total blast. Anything that you would like to tell the nice people about? I know that they can follow you on Twitter.
They can follow me on Twitter at John Ross Bowie, and I'll fill them in with the details. But
It's summertime.
It's summertime. It's a deadly quiet time. Are you auditioning much?
No.
Super quiet right now.
I love it, though. I love not auditioning.
I don't mind it.
That's It's bad when you're in a place where you get an audition and you're like, ugh.
Yeah.
Like, I should be like, oh, great.
Right.
Activity.
Yeah. But it's also summer. And
it's summer.
Yeah.
That's it's just
enjoy this summer. Yeah. I, it's funny. I did a day on a movie the other day, but it went. The way it went down, I was like, I don't think I'm going to survive the cut. I don't think I'm going to be in the finished product, so I'm not going to plug that.
Yeah, I know. I feel like I've had that. That feeling is a very powerful feeling.
It's no fault of my own. It's just like, what is this scene doing here?
I totally.
Do you need this for the rest of the movie to make sense?
Yeah. Could you give me a vital piece of exposition that can be, that must remain?
And usually I'm really lucky with movie roles, and like I have like... I step in. I'm like, listen to me, or Act Two won't make sense. You know,
I have that. Yeah, part. You're a good. You
I've
are.
Been
you're
very,
absolutely
very
right.
lucky.
Yeah.
But this is not the case with this one, so I'm not going to plug it because I don't want to further jinx it.
Yeah. Fuck those guys.
Fuck those guys.
Unless it comes through.
Yeah.
There is one final piece of business. And I'm sorry to have to throw it at you, but it is a tradition of the Boys of Summer series, which is one or both of us, but certainly involving you, singing a snippet of Don Henley's Boys of Summer.
Okay.
Do you remember that song?
Out on the road today, I saw a deadhead sticker on a Cadillac. Little voice inside my head said, don't look back. You can never look back.
Oh, I thought I knew what love was.
What did I know? Terrible lyric.
I know. Those days are gone forever. I should
just let him go, but I can see you. Your brown skin shining in the sun.
You got your hair pulled back.
Hair pulled back?
Like, well, you know what? He does a few different ones. It's that thing where it subtly changes, and then you're like, I don't know what chorus we're on.
There's
nothing fucking
subtle about Don Henley. But, all right.
You're absolutely right.
They stab it with the steely knives corrected. And they still can't kill the beast? No. There is nothing subtle about Don Henley.
But his loyalty remains with the consistency of the final line of the chorus, which is, I can tell you my love for you
will still be strong after the boys of summer have gone. Yeah.
He did it.
All right,
you're a champ.
Thank you.
Thank you. Guys, talk to you next time on the podcast. As always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.